respond, but it was very late.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to call to order this September 15th meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Apprenticeship and State Contracting. Happy to have you here. Boy, it was a long summer. Sorry we weren't able to meet, find a time to meet during the summer. But here we are, and I think we have some interesting work ahead of us during the next couple of hours, a little short of a couple of hours. We are going to be hearing from, we've extended our informational hearings to hear from some small contractors, just to make sure that we have rounded out the voices of who we are hearing from in terms of their needs and, you know, what works for them in terms of apprenticeship utilization. And then we're going to start kind of summarizing the work that we've done so far, where we've looked at a number of models. We've had hearings on a number of models. And just to kind of review those and start talking about the upsides and downsides of each of them. And the goal will be that we will come back one more time, if you'll indulge us in that, in October, to try to come up with a solid recommendation. And I'll talk more about that as we get to that point. Before we do, though, let's just quickly go around the room, start with the table, just to remind ourselves, you know, it's been months since we've seen each other, and, you know, this guy looks completely different, you know.
Right. Every day.
Well, some of us do it for others. But anyway, again, I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23, which is Northeast and Southeast Portland.
Rod Belisle, I'm the training director for the NECA IBW Electrical Apprenticeship Program in Portland.
I'm Carl Redman with Bear Electric and also with the Area 2 JATC Inside Electrical and Independent Electrical Contractors.
Tom Girding with Girding Companies down out of Corvallis, also past president, immediate past president of AGC.
I'm Ron Robbins. I'm a contract administrator for the Carpenters for Oregon Southwest Washington and the co-chair of our statewide JATC.
I'm Kathleen Massier. I'm the program manager for the Workforce Training and Hiring Program at the City of Portland.
I'm Sandy Trainer, Kodiak Pacific Construction. I'm a contractor, civil construction.
John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council.
Barry Jones with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm the program manager for the construction that DAS does within the state.
I'm Mark Johnson. I live in Hood River, and I'm a state representative for House District 52.
And I'm Kathy McEwen. I live in Coos Bay and represent House District 9, which is Coos Bay to Yahats and points east.
Patrick, Task Force staff.
Let's go around. Paloma, you want to introduce yourself?
Paloma Sparks. I'm a website director for Boley.
I'm Rick Cherrier. I'm a small business owner and also the chair of Area 1 Plumbers JACC. I'm on the board of directors. I'm not representing
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
I'm Ron Lowen, and I'm president of PHCC of Oregon. I'm also a business owner, and I have a heating cooling business.
I'm Sean Miller. I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors.
I'm Ken Phillips, the signing supervisor with Berg Electric Corporation, and also an IEC instructor for Area 2. Also sit on the IEC board. And for Berg Electric, I'm the safety and training director as well as the signing supervisor.
Karen Joplin, I'm head of our county commissioner and also a small business owner.
I'm sorry, which county?
Hood River County.
Hood River, thank you.
That county.
That very important county, yes.
That's a pretty nice county.
It's a nice county.
Great, welcome, Commissioner.
Ryan McDonald, also a business owner, McDonald Excavating. Civil construction.
Great. Thank you, Irving.
I'm Arthur Babbitts, mayor of Hood River, and I'm just hanging out here with Senator Thompson.
He wants to convince you he actually works while he's here.
It is an election year.
Darrell Fuller, I'm not from Hood River. I represent the Oregon State Association of Plumbing Heating for the company.
Brian Creed, the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors, Chino Contractors Association, Local 16, that we will be doing tonight.
Hey, you all, I work with Brian, I work with everybody. Frank Johnson, the Oregon Building Trade Council, and the National Contractors Association.
Michael Eisen, Associate General Contractors, South Oregon, Southwest.
I'm Rackowitz with him.
Jack Dempsey, I represent the Carpenters.
Lone Gillis with Senator Denver.
Great. I should tell you that we have a change in personnel on the committee. Gene Kidd has made the decision to retire. Good for him. And so he therefore decided he should probably not be on this task force any longer. So he's being replaced by Nelda Wilson. And you may remember Nelda, who's also with the operating engineers. She gave us a presentation on the apprenticeship council system. And so she's actually going to be part of this when she gets here. Okay, so let's start off with our informational meeting. And we have three people that we're going to hear from to give us a small contractor's perspective on the apprenticeship system. And why don't we have all three of you guys come up at the same time, or you people, I'm sorry, come up at the same time. Sorry, Karen. Ryan McDonald from McDonald Excavating and Karen Joplin from Gorge Electric. And Ron Lewin from Best Heating and Cooling.
Spread the chairs out any way you like down here.
And the one thing we ask of you is that you give us your name, first of all, for the record, and then a presentation on what apprenticeship means, you know, in your daily world. And if we were to have a system in which the state set standards for apprenticeship in terms of numbers, what makes sense from your perspective? So should we just start in the order that you're on the page?
Actually, I think I'm going to go
okay,
first.
Okay, great. Thank
okay.
you, Karen.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today and share with you what it's like to be a small contractor in Oregon. My name is Karen Joplin. I live in Hood River County. I own Gorge Electric. It's an open shop electrical contractor. It was started by my dad in 1981. Through a family succession, I took the business in 1999 and conveniently married an electrician. I have copies of what I'd like to share with you today. I'll just pass around the table. My line of work is being a rural contractor. In order to survive and employ everyone full time, you have to do a little bit of everything. So I do lots of service, lots of new construction, lots of remodel. I do residential, commercial, industrial, and light industrial, lots of control work. We have packing plants in Hood River. We have a fairly robust commercial growth taking place. And also, it's a recreational destination. We have a lot of custom home building taking place as well. I employ 8 electricians and currently 2 apprentices. I know that in some circles that would be very small, but in my circle in Hood River County, that's actually a good size contractor. So I'd like to talk about 2 items. The first is just my experience with working with the apprenticeship program in Oregon and some of the lumps and bumps that I encounter, and then I'll talk a little bit about the bill and item at hand. Area 1, I'm part of JATC Area 1. I'm lumped in with the metro region all through the upper tip of Oregon. My apprentices are required to travel to school into the Portland area. The interested individuals that I find in Hood River County, they face many barriers trying to access these opportunities. Looking past the difficult application requirements and the timing of their ability to apply, there are windows of application throughout the year. In past years, those windows have been as small as 1 week. In addition to those barriers, they're required to travel upwards of 120 to 140 miles to access their educational opportunity. It's an expense, especially in today's gas prices. It's an expense for these individuals. They're often seeking a stronger financial stability, so their starting point is often a place of financial stress. They're typically younger individuals in their early 20s. They've started young families. They're trying to make things work for their small families. They're putting themselves out there. It's a burden. It's an expense. It's difficult to access programs that are located so far away. I may know a fantastic community member who wants to stay in my community and wants to be a part of the business that I operate, and I'm not able to hire that person because they have to be accepted into the JATC program in Portland first. They have to compete and apply with all of the metro region potential apprentices. So when people come into my office, high school kids, people that just know my business from around the community, and they want to come in and they ask me, what do I do to get a job with you? I want to work with you. I have to tell them that I can only hire outside, out of the JATC program. They must go and apply. They must jump the hoops and get through. If they make it to the ready-to-work list, I could hire them. It's a daunting experience. It closes the doors for many qualified potential apprentices. The ready-to-work list that I'm provided from JATC, 99.9999% of the time, those individuals live in the metro region. When I call these individuals and ask them to come and work for me, due to obvious reasons of costs of travel and the burden of out-of-town work, they're not able to accept my offer. When they refuse offered work, they get bumped off the ready-to-work list. The ones that will accept the travel, they will accept the position, the reality becomes that they're not good employees. They're not reliable. Traveling the gorge in the winter is often impassable. It doesn't work. I don't hire them. In a time of need for job creation and growth in rural Oregon, east of the Cascades, these unnecessary barriers diminish the ability of small businesses like myself to hire qualified individuals. I could hire 2 electricians and 3 apprentices today. I won't be able to do that. I won't be able to do that for the rest of the year or next year. They're not there. I'm behind in my work. I can barely keep up. All of the electrical contractors in Hood River are completely maxed out. There are no journeymen to be found. And the apprentice system, the way it stands, does not support our community. A couple of comments on the proposed legislation at hand that you're really examining on the utilization. I truly question if you're receiving accurate data about current utilization of apprentices. Do you really think that the apprenticeship utilization is low and this legislation is intended to increase the use of apprentices? If that's the understanding, that's incorrect. Contractors use apprentices whenever they possibly can. We make money off of them. You don't have to pay them as much. We would use as many as we absolutely most possibly could. So if some information is showing you that contractors are not using apprentices, it's incorrect information. Smaller employers like myself in rural areas, they may or may not have the ability to be training agents. Training agents, there are requirements in place in order to be one. There are costs associated with apprentices. You pay a per hour rate. And you have to have enough staff to support the ratio of utilizing an apprentice. For small, rural, mom-and-pop contractors around eastern Oregon, those requirements alone could be barriers to participate in that program. This type of stringent regulation that you're potentially proposing of ratios and requirements of certain use, utilization of apprentices, could potentially close out small business owners from taking care of our schools, our port buildings, our state offices. We maintain, build, renovate all of these buildings in rural Oregon. They're part of our community. They employ us to take care of those buildings, and that's how our local economies work. Such regulations of not allowing us to perform that type of work based on not having enough apprentices, it just might not fit for us. It's a question of all of Oregon, not just the I-5 corridor. There are a lot of us that work on the east side of the Cascades. We work in our communities, with the communities that support us, in our local economies, and it works. I find that it has the potential to limit private enterprise. So my question is why? Why would you do this? Why would you not support our ability to work in our local economies and support our communities within? The item number four, when it talks about significant funds, a very vague statement. What does that mean? Are we talking $10 or $10 million? It's a very scary terminology for small contractors. In closing, I'd like to begin the conversation of removing barriers and boundaries of the joint apprentice training committees and allowing community colleges to provide these educational curricula around rural Oregon in a more accessible way for those that live in rural Oregon. All electrical journeymen take the very same state test. The training program to get there is not rocket science. You pass it, you become a journeyman. You don't pass it, you take it again and try again. All community colleges are smart about delivering curricula. They know how to graduate successful graduates that can pass these tests. I encourage the opening of the apprenticeship program so that more rural potential apprentices can enter the field of tradesmen. Historically very strong jobs. I provide well-paying jobs in a small community with family benefits. And I have jobs that are open that I cannot fill. I believe the current market for apprentices is a closed market, and I think that is bad for rural Oregon. Again, contractors will use apprentices whenever possible, as they are moneymakers. It does not make sense to create law that regulates the utilization of apprentices. It is completely unnecessary, but what it might possibly do is create barriers for smaller contractors like myself. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Karen. Why don't we hold off on questions, unless you have any that are really specific to her. And yes, Rep. Johnson.
Karen, I appreciate your testimony. Have there been situations where you have chosen to not bid on a specific commercial job, maybe a school district job, something, larger project, simply because you knew that you wouldn't be able to man up and have the workforce available to actually fulfill the contract?
Yes.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have a quick question, Karen. So does your firm do state work?
Yes.
Because that's what we're focused on here. You mentioned renovation of state buildings or something. Could you give us an example of some of the, you know, the the state work that your company does?
Well, I said renovation improvements. There's been a lot of lighting retrofits. We've worked in schools, DHS offices, the port buildings, lot of lighting retrofits, new construction of port buildings, and lots of service distribution overhauls. The buildings that are located within our communities, those are the buildings that I take care of. I maintain them, renovate them, improve them, and conduct new construction.
Okay. And what are the contract levels that, you know, if, so the original bill that stimulated this had a $5 million floor. Is that
a contract, a project total, or a subcontract total? If it's
that
a $5 million
project.
Total project.
Yeah.
There's multiple projects in my community that would exceed the $5 million.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Ron.
Just in some of the testimony that's been given in some of the studies we've done, there appears to be 17 community colleges in the state that have electrical or mechanical programs. There's not one in Hood River, huh?
We have a great community college in Hood River, but the JATC Area 1 education is provided in Portland. All apprentices must travel to that office. And Area 1 is Hood River, Multnomah, Clackamas, all the way up the tip of Oregon.
Yes, John. And who sets the areas?
If you could tell me that, we'd both know.
Well, I'm guessing somebody in this room's got to know.
Any other maps, the BOLI prevailing wage regions, there's no similarity between the regions.
I don't know if that's the State Apprenticeship Council that does that or if it's the committees themselves that draw their boundaries. I don't know.
Territorial division, yeah, of the state, so that every section of the state would have one apprenticeship training program.
I understand that. I'm just wondering who's responsible for the borders.
Well,
so I happen to yeah. an introduction.
Yes. Yeah. So I mentioned before that we have a new task force member, thanks to Gene retiring. And I think because Gene retired, now the average age of apprentices has at last gone down a little. Or, no, not apprentices, but workers in the trade. Nelda's taking his place. Thank you very much, Nelda.
Okay.
So, Nelda, you're involved with the JATC system. And
right, and I'm vice chair of the State Apprenticeship Council. But just, you know, with that hat on, they're usually, it's where you have employers, right? So Area 1, and I don't know the history of it, but it's typically where there's employers that JATC services. So at some point it was reasonable probably for Area 1 to be those counties or those regions.
Okay. Yes, Rip Johnson.
How many areas do we have in the state?
Five. There are seven.
Seven. Okay. Carl?
It depends upon the programs. I think on the there's 14 programs, JATC type programs in our industry in the state.
In electrical.
Yeah. So, not necessarily all separate areas, but there are some where there's, like over on the coast, a community college type of program, which also might be served by a different JATC that still has some common geographic area.
So, Karen, in the past, has your community college provided this service?
No, we've not been allowed to.
It's happened in other areas in the past. I just wondered if you'd had one that's now no longer there. Not the case?
Okay. Yes, Greg and Rod.
I think the way that the curriculum is delivered, the RSI, is up to the JATC to decide. I know in our program, historically, we use Clatsop Community College to provide training. We use the college up in the gorge to provide training. And we have varied that depending on our needs, depending on our population. So the concerns of how that service area is provided would be up to the JATC. And I think additionally, there are programs within our area or within the Salem over to Bend area where that's one JATC, but they have two ranked lists. So they have the ability for an applicant to come from Bend, apply to the program, and be on a list that only would service Bend. And that's a decision, again, the JATC has made. So perhaps Area 1 could look at their demographic, and if they chose to have applicants from Hood River and the Gorge be on a separate list, they could establish that criteria.
And if I heard you right, then they could establish training there as well if they decided to make that decision and fund it.
Okay, great.
That helps.
Yes.
Karen, do you know then whether folks east of us, the Dalles and so forth, have to drive, are they driving to Mount Hood also for their training? Or is there a closer destination heading east?
Actually, Wasco headed east at the, I don't know if you can see, but it's
Wasco's
the...
Wasco's not in that same, you're saying...
No, the orange wraps around, and they're in a completely different area, and their travel, they used to be able to provide in the Dalles at the old Treaty Oaks, which I think evolved into the community college. So
Columbia
I do believe
Gorge.
There's probably some access at the community college in the Dalles for all of Area 6, which wraps around an enormous piece of Oregon. So if you have somebody down here in Lakeview...
Yeah.
It's just not attainable.
Yeah.
Yes, Nelda.
On one of our local union JATCs, we contract with the community colleges, and they also require a minimum that's going to take the classes before they'll put them on. So that might be some of the issues, just the population of apprentices is too low to make it, you know, advantageous for the community college to host the courses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Karen, you've obviously opened up an interesting issue, and it's one that we have, you know, certainly, you know, we've heard here before, the challenge of the geographical diversity of the state, right? And that is, you know, the special challenges that the rural areas have. And, you know, I think as we're looking to a set of recommendations coming out of this task force, that's obviously got to be a factor that we're looking at. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't think you're alone in Hood River in dealing with this problem either.
Right.
No, I'm positive I'm not.
Yeah, I think geography can become a serious challenge in many places.
Okay, why don't we move on then to, let's hear from, well who's next?
I'll go next.
Okay.
Get that microphone over to you a little bit, just so we can keep the official legislative record going.
Thanks, Ron. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Ryan McDonald. I'm a small business owner. I also, my dad started the company in 1980. And here in 2004, I went back to work for him when I got out of college. And just over the last couple of years, we've done a succession plan where I'm working him out. And so he gets a nice check every month, and I gotta stay and do all the work.
How's that working?
Where are you located?
We're out of Washougal, Washington.
Washougal, okay. Thank
so
you.
So just across the river from Portland, pretty much. So we are also a minority business enterprise and also a disadvantaged business. We're a union shop. Which is kind of unique. You don't see a lot of minority businesses that are union. I'm not nearly as prepared. I read through the bill. I haven't seen any specific numbers thrown out as far as where this is going, as far as apprenticeship goals or percentages or any of that. But I do know from my experience on the Selwood Bridge project, the Portland-Milwaukee, pretty much all the major projects in the Portland area we've been a part of in some way, shape, or form as a subcontractor to the larger generals. And I do know that the goals in that region are 20%, and they're extremely hard to meet and sometimes mathematically impossible to meet with the ratios that you got to stay in with, you know, for instance, as an example, you know, if I have a job that requires 16 operators, well, according to the ratios, I can only have 3 apprentices on that crew. Well, if you do the math, it doesn't meet the 20%. So it creates us making decisions to meet the goal rather than decisions to do what's best for the project. Because as you know, there's also always time constraints on projects, so we end up being forced to modify our crew just in the name of making these goals. There's also the other extreme where you might be on a project where you need one operator and you can have one apprentice, and you know, you have instances where maybe your journeyman calls in sick that day. Well, what does your apprentice do? Well, to stay within ratio, theoretically, you got to send them home, or we get penalized to, we either have to pay that apprentice journeyman scale for that day because he doesn't have his supervisor on site. So there's a lot of, there's also safety considerations too. You know, we're on some job sites where, Selwood is a great example. We're working under, you know, 250,000 volt power lines, and we're working in the water in a creek with extreme environmental issues. You know, that's probably not the place to train somebody. And like I said, I don't know how this applies really to the bill other than just considerations for you guys to take in. You know, at the end of the day, I think the goal should be to, you know, I guess some points that I jotted down was, you know, if there's going to be a goal, it shouldn't be trade specific. It shouldn't favor union or non-union. And it's got to be realistic. In other words, there's got to be some cushion to where, you know, if you're right at the, if the ratios make it to where you can't meet the goal, that obviously doesn't work for contractors.
But there's got to be some flexibility in it. So.
Exactly. And then the other problem, I think, which I think is the root of the cause, is, you know, a lot of, we obviously know we have a problem with the workforce. Our, a lot of times the apprentices that we see coming out are in their mid-20s or 30s. You know, it's like, well, what have they been doing since high school? You know, well, I think the thought process nowadays is that, you know, everyone gets pushed off to go to college. Well, not everyone's made to go to college. And I think, you know, we need to get, there needs to be an emphasis on getting the trades back in high schools and middle schools so people can make these decisions, because it's really a disservice to the young people to go waste 10 years of their life doing something that they're not made to do because some counselor told them that, you know, you need to go to college to be successful. You know, we got operators that are making 100 grand a year. I mean, it's, so I think more emphasis needs to be on that than creating a law to police us as contractors, because we know there's a problem. We pay for the mistakes when we have apprentices on our job. I had one this last year where an apprentice misread a grade rod by a foot and cut the grade too deep, and we had to spend $35,000 on rock to fill it back in, you know. So to think that us as contractors, you know, that we don't have a problem is flawed. So that's my 2 cents.
Thank you, Ryan. Yes, Nelda.
Mind if I respond for a couple of those?
Please.
So, Ryan, I'm Nelda Wilson. I'm the business manager, the operating engineer. So I appreciate you being here today. But I know that's something that the council has worked around. You know, kind of what do we do with an apprentice that is on a like critical job, where, you know, you're digging around power lines or you've got a, you know, situation. And I know for us, we'll dispatch out a 90% apprentice so that you've got somebody with some experience. And I know the electrical, and we're kind of thinking about the same thing. I know the electricians have, if you're a 95% apprentice, you can work some unsupervised. And so that's something that the council's been approving here just in the last, I don't know, year and a half, because we understand that there's needs to be some flexibility. But the JATCs are also charged with safety of the apprentices, so that's the concern, is when are they, you know, competent enough and safe enough to work alone. And it really is up in that last period before they journey out to be journeymen, because then they can work alone. So makes some sense to not have them totally unsupervised, but to, you know, allow some alone time there.
And, you know, the other problem is availability, you know. Of course, it's been kind of a unique year when you got Intel going, you got the Portland-Milwaukee light rail going, you got the Sellwood Bridge. You're talking several $1 billion worth of work, and you know, availability is an issue. You know,
we currently have 50 in our pool of eligibles, so we've got plenty of apprentices.
Ryan, did you have anything to do with the new pedestrian light rail bridge that's going over the Willamette?
Yeah, we did.
Etillicum Crossing. Mm-hmm. I was just on there in the end of last week. Very windy day, but the bridge didn't sway at all. Thank you.
Probably a good thing.
Yes. Kathleen,
that's
you
break you out. this way.
The city of Portland has that 20% requirement. Have you come across the problem of it bumping up against the JETC maximums?
So I think, sort of to clarify on that, it's not your ratio isn't 20%. It's 20% of your hours in the trade needs to be worked by state registered apprentices. So for us, we don't. I mean, yes, there are some instances, especially with operators, probably where there might be instances where firms have a difficult time reaching that 20%. Of course, you know, we look at the projects, we take those kinds of things into consideration when they're brought to our attention up front. And so, you know, by and large, though, I think there aren't a lot of trades where firms struggle to meet the 20%. A lot of times we see them exceeding it. But, I mean, operators is a little bit of a unique trade, and so, you know, it's understandable that that could be an issue.
Kathleen, are there other cities who have that requirement, or is Portland the only one that's imposing that?
Salem or Eugene? Portland's the only one I know of that has a program, and most of the agencies within the Portland metro area have that requirement.
Thank you.
Tom?
I think it's an interesting piece that if you pulled amongst industry that largely the apprenticeship pool, the 20% requirements suck up a lot of apprenticeship availability to other projects. Mm-hmm. That when we call and ask for apprentices and there's no apprentices available, so just one piece to I think to highlight is a specific entity or some specific projects having that extreme of a goal. I don't think the industry is able to come close to supporting that piece. And it'd be interesting, I think, if we talked amongst our union friends here and said, do they have the availability if every project out there was trying to attain 20%, do they have the apprentices to make that? And all of that to be said, holistically, in not to circumvent, but Ryan, I appreciate what you brought up about trying to fill the pipeline of people to come into the apprentices, because the interesting thing here is I don't think anybody in this room would say, you know, we need incentive to get apprentices being hired. Industry wants apprentices. We want workforce. We're all in that same boat. So ultimately, I think that's a very important piece to be cognizant of as we talk about utilization rates that really, because I think, Ryan, if we went to you, and certainly hearing from you, Karen, you guys don't need a gun held to your head to hire apprentices. If it fits, it's economically feasible. Get them in there and get them going. It's where are we going to even get these apprenticeships? So to be talking about imposing requirements on us to hire apprentices when we're all going, yeah, we're all on, bring them. You know, I think the pipeline is really the big issue to be talking about too.
And that may come back to the CTE issue that I think we're going to address a little bit later. Yeah.
Ryan, you mentioned that yours is a minority disadvantaged firm. Is there anything that we should be considering that's unique to that kind of firm?
No, I think it shares the same concerns as any small business. You know, for instance, you know, last night I was at the office bidding a job till 10:30. Well, these things take up a lot of time when you got to sit there and figure out and manipulate your crews and take guys that maybe have worked for you for 5 years and keep them home because you got to meet a goal. And it, you know, it's a huge time constraint, and for companies that have people that wear all hats like myself and Karen, you know, it's a huge mountain to climb all the time.
Okay. Well, why don't we move on? Ron, you want to take over?
Yeah,
Ryan, can you get in the microphone, sir?
My name's Ron Lowen, and I own a business in Sial, Oregon. It's Best Heating and Cooling, and I have Best Heating and Control. I do mechanical work. I do controls. I do a lot of service. I'm also the president of PHCC of Oregon, and I represent plumbing and heating cooling contractors throughout the state. And we have a diverse group of contractors that belong to us, union and non-union. I'd like to kind of focus on what I personally have dealt with. I was the chair of the Area 2 HVACR committee, which is the Mid-Valley, for 18 years. I was involved in it when it started in 1987. I started my business myself in 1990 and have survived to this point. But the challenges that I face have steadily changed and become more difficult with time. The selection method that we're forced to use, I run into the same problems the electrician here to my left has ran into. I'm in a little community. I'm in a little town. When I was on the chair of the committee, our training agents at the coast had 2 to 3 hour drive times to come to school. The apprenticeship program, in my opinion, is broken because it's not very flexible. We have struggled to try to take care of those issues, but we haven't been able to retain apprentices in any of the rural or outlying areas. It seems very difficult. And when we get them trained, they tend to move to the metro areas because that's where most of the work is and that's less driving. So it's been a real challenge. Our numbers have steadily declined. As far as participation, I mean, right now we have an upgrowth, but none of us can hire enough people or train enough people. There's more work than I can do. I could hire 4 more people and keep them busy, but they're not available. And I think that's a story you'll hear from every contractor that I represent. So we've got a serious issue with having enough people trained fast enough. The other issue we deal with on the HVAC and control side, it's a steadily changing environment. Technology is moving ahead. Manufacturers are changing the way things are done quickly. Our education systems that are in place are behind that. I train my crew largely myself and with YouTube videos now, changing my technology and factory schools. We're sending them to factory schools all the time because you can't sell and put in a piece of equipment unless you've went through their schooling. But all that schooling is unapproved training time that it's not recognized by the apprenticeship program. But it's necessary for them to do their job. So I find this as a lot of difficult problems. In the environment that I'm in right now, the decision I've made is I used to do a lot of prevailing wage government projects, and I've decided to do none of them because I find them to be difficult to comply with everything compared to working on the private side. My HVAC side is largely a non-licensed trade. It's a trade that you have to have a bunch of different licenses for, but they're all attainable outside the apprenticeship program. The electrical license that I hold and part of my people hold are required to have an apprenticeship program. But on the service side for plumbers and HVAC, the cost of training an apprentice is very high. On the construction side of my business, I make money out of the apprentices because I can effectively use that labor. But on the technician side, I'm sending 2 people to a job. And if I sent them to your house and charge for both of those people to work on your furnace, when only one of them can get in front of that furnace, you would write me a nasty letter about what I charged, and you would never call me back. So, and that's the same thing true with a service plumber. But if you do not give these apprentices that kind of training, they will never be able to do that kind of work. And you can't learn that in school. It's customer service. I'm fixing a box, but more importantly, I'm fixing the customer. The customer has concerns, comfort issues. They're concerned about their carpet. They're concerned about what are you going to, don't let the dog out. There's a whole bunch of different things. And if you're working in industry, they're concerned about privacy. Everybody has state-of-the-art technology. They don't want walking out the door. I have to sign security and privacy agreements for almost all my industrial customers, and all my employees have to also sign those. So it's an issue. They don't want you to come in the door unless you're pre-qualified and the person that you're bringing has been vetted by you before you come in. It creates a lot of complexity with the way we get apprentices. It's a model that don't work for my business personally, but the companies I represent have to do it because they're licensed trades. So we have a huge challenge. The adding more complexity to it will take more people out of the competition, which will raise the cost of all public projects, in my opinion. I think we need to have a easier system that's less rigid to work, because in rural Oregon, where I deal with it, it don't work.
Thank you very much, Ron. Questions? How large is your firm, Ron?
Right now I have 8 people in the field, and I have 8 in the office that are engineers and customer service.
So no apprentices, because you're not doing the construction side?
I have no state registered apprentices at this time. No, I do construction side. Okay. I just don't do no government work.
Gotcha.
That is bid work. I do a lot of maintenance for 4 different cities. I do a lot of county work, but it's all maintenance, repair, fixing things.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, Michael, Ron, I come from a rural community. I live in Coos Bay. We deal with these issues of, you know, the rural challenges all the time. And I think, Mike, you touched on a couple of things that I don't know if it's a chicken or an egg problem or not, but, you know, the distance traveled for training is difficult if you're from the coast. And you commented that once people are trained, you tend to lose them to the metro area because that's where the jobs are. But we have jobs on the coast too, and you have jobs in your area. So I'm just trying to think through how we can possibly deal with that, you know, the training side of things. When we do have some jobs, we don't have as many. Certainly we're always going to be in competition. But what would you suggest we do about that? I mean, how do you deal with the issue of, you know, they get trained and they're going to go where the jobs are. They're not going to want to come back to the coast or go back to SIO. But we do need them trained because there are some opportunities for small shops. What do you think?
The problem is I've hired people through the selection method. They don't live in my community. They drive to my shop to come to work. Once they turn out as a journeyman, why would you drive an hour and a half to go to work when you can go to work down the street?
Yeah.
And so that's what happens to them. And so I can't hire somebody outside my community and put the expense of training them and expect to retain them. And for me as a businessman, to spend $130,000 is what it cost me to train my last apprentice does not make good business sense. I'm not going to spend $130,000 on somebody that I don't have a reasonable sense that they will stay in my, that they will be in my business, because I don't get my return on investment. If I'm doing the construction side, that is completely different, because I can utilize that labor and they can pay as they go through. So two separate hats.
Right.
The trouble with our business is we're all different. It's not one hat fits all, and our apprenticeship program is designed around a one hat fits all scenario, and I think that's where we have the issue.
So if you got to be king for a day, how would you solve it?
Well, I would go back to the employer hiring somebody and bringing them on board, and if they showed up, did their work, then after about 3 months, then have them go into that, ask them to go sign up as an apprentice for that local company is what I would recommend. Because what I have done, I mean, the people I have hired that I went outside the state system because I found it so unsuccessful are all local people that are living in the town I'm in, that want to live there, that parents live there. There's a good chance I can keep them there, and I can risk spending the money to train them. I mean, because I believe I'll get a return on investment. And also, when you hire somebody, if I'm hiring them for a service tech, it's quite a different person. I need a people person. I need a problem solver. But if I'm hiring them for an installer, I need a craftsman. I need somebody that's probably more introverted and that can really understand and make something with their hands. So two different kind of people for two different types of crafts that need to occur. And you can't change those. We are who we are. And it has
different shops going in essence.
You have completely different scenarios, and the person that's a good technician is not a good construction guy. And the guy that's a good construction guy or gal, it don't matter, can't, you try to get them over here and they're out of their comfort zone, they don't do good. So it takes a special makeup. It's not one size fits all to fit into each of these positions. And if I'm sending them to your house to work on your furnace, if you don't like them, you'll never use me again. You know, so it's very important that if that person has to be a people person. Yes, they have to be able to fix the box, but they have to not walk across your floor with muddy shoes. They have to not let the cat escape. They have to respect your home as if it was their own, or more like mom's house, that she's not going to be mad if she has to clean up. And if that's not the type of person you have, that don't work.
I'd like to touch on the comment about YouTube. How much, can you quantify how much time you think your personnel spend on individualized training for specific installations that you mentioned over the course of a year that is not?
I can tell you that in my shop, the average length of time of reading instructions or going over training is 4 hours a week per person. That's journeyman all the way down to an apprentice. The reason is everything you put in today is complex. And if you put it in wrong, just as a gentleman on my left, now I'm working for free. It broke down. It don't work. The manufacturer don't cover labor. They'll cover parts, but if I burn the parts up and they know I did, I'm buying those too.
The industry is changing in that the educational component for your folks is increasing,
dramatically.
And that's just the lay of the land. That's the way it's going to be.
It's going to, yes. As we gain efficiency, we gain complexity. Mm-hmm. And with complexity, it requires a much greater level of skill and ability to learn.
But does that change the landscape for the people that you would want to bring into an apprenticeship program? Is that changing the dynamic?
It does. The people that I hire to train, I test. I test their math skills. I do a psychological test. I go through a big, long line of things because the cost of me hiring the wrong person is expensive. It's expensive if they cost me a customer, if they make a mistake. It's terrible expensive. But at the same time, if they do a good job, they make me good money. So it's like any hiring anybody else. You want to put the best person, man, woman, don't matter, there. You need somebody that understands to keep your risk low and understands what is it going to take to satisfy the customer. And it don't matter about me, because if they satisfy the customer, I do well.
Ron, let me ask you about that. You know, in this service side where there's not a formal apprenticeship system, how do new people get the hands-on training that they need?
They ride along with the journeyman and work under their supervision, just like an apprenticeship program. We have an apprenticeship program for that in the Mid-Valley, but I find it's broken because I can't hire who I want to.
Okay.
That's the problem. And if I can't retain them, why am I going to spend this large amount of money and time
right.
to train them if I can't, if I'm not going to get a return on investment?
Well, let me throw the question out to those of you on the task force who work with JATCs. We've heard in varying degrees from all three of our witnesses that there are issues with inflexibility in the current system. Rod, you feel that the system does have the capacity for flexibility, but we're hearing kind of multiple examples of this. Could you or any others, do you have some thoughts about how we can make this more flexible or if there are accommodations within the existing system?
Well, I know for our JATC, I have eight bosses. I have eight JETC members, and they all have different work they do, large contractor, small contractor. We have union representatives, and we have members from the field. So I think the JETC has the ability to be flexible. They just have to choose to do so. I think they have to be willing to look at issues like this. I mean, what I'm hearing as I sit here, I'm inclined to go back to my meeting, which I happen to have tomorrow, and ask my contractors, are these issues for you? Because if they are, then the question becomes, what should we do about it? If my committee were to choose to not do anything, then I would expect that our contractors that are located in the Dalles and in Stevenson and the remote areas would probably have the same perspective, that they're not being served. And I know from my perspective, I don't like to get a phone call from an employer who's unhappy. So if I can meet those needs, I think the majority of our employers are getting what they want, and so we can focus on the needs of those that aren't. So I think the system is there. It's up to the JATC to be proactive and choose to do that.
Thanks. Carl, you want to comment?
Earlier when we were talking about areas, it looks like the areas are the same, but I did just double check. On inside electrical, there are 18 programs within the state that somebody could be part of. And those programs all have state-approved standards by the State Apprenticeship Training Council. And so I think part of the challenge is when time changes, some of the inflexibility is just through a structure. For example, the Area 1 and Area 2 inside electrical programs submitted a request to look at the minimum guidelines, and one of the components was ratio. So that request goes to the subcommittee to be decided on holding that meeting. From the subcommittee, and please correct me if I don't tell this correct, then that goes to the full council to have that decision ratified or verified. And then after that, the minimum guideline committee can be convened, which is made up of representatives from all of those 18 JATCs. So then that group gets together, proposes a change or not, and if everybody's on the same page, then you're pretty much good to go. If they're not, then you have minority opinion, majority opinion, which then you go back to the council to see what's going to happen. So it can be daunting, to get through that process. That's one component. Another component of it is in the program, like in Area 2 JATC, all the counties that are within the geographic area of that, when an applicant to be in the apprenticeship program fills that out, they mark which counties they're willing to work in. So there's a pros and cons to that. Is one, if you just mark the county where you're at, you're limiting possibly the number of people who are going to approach you to come and work for them as an apprentice. So some will check them all. So you could have somebody who lives at one end of that area and their name comes up on the list, so they get the phone call from the employer at the opposite end of the area. And if they turn down that employment a couple times, then they're bumped. So what can happen is you take that job. Once you're employed, if you terminate your employment, then you go on the out-of-work list. If you're on the out-of-work list, you're allowed to go out and seek employment from any training agent who will hire you. So I think some of the challenges are, like we heard, that you hire an apprentice and they're from out of your area, it's possible that they're taking that job, they'll do that job, they'll do a good job, but as soon as it looks like somebody in the local area has an opening, they can leave that job and hope that other training agent will hire them. So I think some of the challenges are just in how the programs operate. We had a similar experience when the economy all got better. We have electricians that have both Oregon and Washington licenses, and some of those people like live down in Salem. Well, some of those journeymen decided not to renew their Washington license. And the reason for that is because if they held a Washington license, they were afraid they'd have to go work in Washington. And if they didn't have it, they could stay close to home. It's a similar scenario within the apprenticeship program. Is the wider area you allow yourself to go to, you may have to go. And with more and more employment opportunities, fortunately, occurring closer to home, we're seeing a greater reluctance to doing that. And I also just wanted to touch, too, on a similar component that was brought up about if there's a mandate, where do your apprentices go? Like in the city of Portland, if you work, like, say, the South Waterfront District, and you have the goals to meet for minorities, women, so forth, and those percentages, and we have people that fit all those descriptions, so, and we're doing some work down there, so we might be taking the minority and women people on our workforce that live in Silverton, but now they all have to go work in Portland because that job has those requirements. And so I think that would be a component that we need to be mindful of, whatever we come up with here, where we're trying to solve one problem and get increased participation on the part of apprentices, that we could actually do damage because we're doing something that that apprentice will now be, in their eyes, penalized for. I have to drive 100 miles to work because I fit the bill for a goal on a project someplace. So I think I agree with what Rod's comments were, that within the JETCs, things could be done to make things simpler. There's new methods of delivering education. Maybe we could look at how these areas are broken down. Maybe we could look at what program do you have to be in. You know, we could look back on some things that were done in the past where it used to be somebody could come to your door. I'd love to come to work for you. And if that looked like a good idea on both parties, we could hire that person and indenture them as an apprentice. And I know there were some things that came along the way about, okay, well, how do we, with that process, how do we ensure that minorities, women, and those goals are met? Well, maybe we need to look at some different ways that we ensure those things happen that make it easier.
Thank you. Nelda?
That is a big challenge, and it happens to us on the ODOT jobs, especially when you have ODOT doing its own enforcement of apprenticeship and its own enforcement of civil rights. Can be different than Boley. So we sort of have this mixed bag going in the state. And then, like, South Waterfront is a, you know, that's an isolated pocket where we have higher goals and higher diversity goals. But, and I realize it doesn't work for employers, but if my memory is right, from being on the state committee, when employers had the opportunity to just indenture people directly to their company or that employer choice every 24 months, those people were always white male predominantly. And so then that's a problem for the JETC who's trying to meet EEOC goals, or a company that's trying to, a larger company. So that's, I know the selection methods have been kind of squeezed down because of that, because the statistics are just all white male, you know, so there's no diversity then in the workforce. And so that is kind of, how do you get that balance? And one way, you know, I had an employer that ceased to do work in the state of Oregon because of ODOT and the civil rights, because they had their diverse crew, you know, on one side of the state working, but they had a white male apprentice on this one project, and ODOT just crucified him for it. And we wrote letters saying, hey, this is a good employer. They've trained apprentices. They've kept those diverse apprentices on as journey workers. They just don't happen to be at this job. And that's what we want. We don't want just jobs for one person for a short job. We're looking for careers. And so we encourage our employers to keep those people that you've trained. You know, if you've got your females and your ethnic minorities, keep them working. Make them part of your crew. But then when they do that, then there's this disconnect. Well, I need to have this apprentice diversity also. And that can be a problem, and then it's a problem when you only look at one job. You need to look at the employer's universe more so, and then the JATC. I know we're pushing at the state council level JATCs to have, you know, 9% women and 16% ethnic minorities. So a JATC could indenture somebody as long as their numbers were good and it didn't drop them into that red zone, you know, for this council to say, why do you have too many white males, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I think it broadening the way we look at companies and multiple jobs is really a must to have this work. And then diversity can't just be an apprenticeship. It has to be your whole workforce. You know, and that's where South Waterfront is different. And this is a point I've argued forever here, is that, you know, you can have all your right ratios in your journeyman workforce, and then all of your apprentices could be white males. You know, we just can't, we got to look at the whole basket, not just a piece of it.
Mm-hmm. So we have to look at the present, and we have to look at the future as
yeah.
far as.
So can I call up
yes.
Ryan. The operating engineers and dispatch a minority female apprentice?
Yes, if we have one available, we'll send them to you. So we don't, we will pierce the list when we have contractual, you know, like the community benefits agreements, like South Waterfront, when we actually have a contractual obligation, or the City of Portland, that kind of stuff.
Barrier in the past in some jobs where, you know, the union as a whole.
Ron, could you get Brian the microphone?
It's been a barrier in the past where the, you know, your group as a whole meets the diversity, but me as a small contractor, when I call someone out of the hall, without those agreements in place, you guys can't make those special arrangements. So, you know,
yeah,
we're stuck with what
we really
get.
Work hard to, you know, we really try to accommodate our employers, and the same thing with the geographical areas. We really, you know, let them know, hey, we've got an apprentice at the top of our list. He's from your area, you know him.
But that doesn't mean it's fair to the other members on your list.
And that's the juggle, because we were unfortunate enough to have a reverse discrimination charge,
because
exactly. The white males were not getting dispatched, and so you have that obligation too. So that's why I'm against diversity just coming from apprenticeship. I mean, we really need to look at the journey workers and the whole company, you know, because that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sandy.
I did want to make a comment from the contractor side. I'm civil, so operator, engineer, open shop. And we have trouble just getting apprentices, much less minority apprentices. And, you know, I'm doing two big jobs out at the airport, PDX, right now, and they cannot furnish apprentices to me, much less of minority or women capacity. I have a lot of women escort drivers and flaggers, so we're filling that. But the other minority side, you know, it's just not there. And I do feel that it's this barrier of entry that's an issue, because I could hire a minority if they came to my door and make them an apprentice and, as you say, put up the financial backing for the training. That's not even an issue. But when you have to have a third party decide who's going to be over here in the silo, and you're going to be lucky to get what you get, and they may be there. So how do you bid a job? And as he stated, and you've stated, that on public contracting, sometimes you just don't bid it. And
well,
that's not helping the programs.
Right. Let me ask this question in terms of the lack of apprenticeship pools. I sit on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We had a presentation last week by the Oregon Tradeswomen group. And they seem to be doing some really good work on the pre-apprenticeship side, getting people into the pipeline and qualified to, you know, to apply for apprenticeship. And they're looking at strategies for expanding their work beyond the metro area to all over the state. Would that help your problem, Sandy?
Well, I've worked with Connie quite a bit, and I have hired some of her women for roller operators. But being on the civil excavation side, those pre-apprentices really don't move into operators to speak of. Roller operators maybe, but not as many excavating operators. So that's become an issue for me.
Yeah, but that's a craft issue.
And that's part of our problem is everything is different. you know, with your service and, you know, your construction side, your construction side and commercial and residential and public. And there's so many different aspects to it. This JATC one hat only just doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm. Ron?
As far as capacity, it's interesting. We're over 700 apprentices now in the state, and I have 250 people on my eligibles list. So we could grow by a third tomorrow if I had the jobs to place them in. Mm-hmm. The folks are coming to the apprenticeship programs because there's opportunity now. So many young people that thought they were, you know, relinquished to mom's couch in the basement are finding that there's actual jobs out there, and that's exciting. On the minority side, I applaud the work that the city's done and the commitment the South Waterfront's done. It's uncomfortable to have requirements. I mean, it is. Because what that kind of says is that we're failing to do something, right? Okay. And so in the case of South Waterfront, the city did a disparity study, and they looked at the numbers of the workforce, and they were, you know, very disparaging, to say the least. As an organization, each of the apprenticeship programs, we have EEOC goals, and we strive to meet those. Without those, without the requirements, without those goals, I know because I network with individuals. You know, I have women that are in the Carpenters Union. That's not traditionally a woman's job, if there is one anymore, but that, you know, isn't viewed that way. And so they have to deal with that barrier. Without those requirements, I can't keep women employed long enough to become journeymen, to become that next workforce. We need requirements, unfortunately, because without them, we didn't diversify. And so I'm a drywaller by trade. I mean, I don't want to share with you what the numbers are for female drywallers, but it's horrible, you know. I think out of the local of 1,500 drywallers, we have maybe 2 or 3% female. Now, that's not acceptable, and we need help to deal with that. And help means careers for those young women, you know, a place that they, not just a job, but a next job and a next job. So if requirements, as uncomfortable as they make us all, you know, helps that happen, I'm all for it.
Well, you know, and I'm not, and I disagree with that, because a requirement is just a requirement. And my feeling is we're supposed to help bring in apprentices and help minorities and help women have jobs. And if there's jobs available, any good contractor is going to hire whoever wants a job and is willing to work. You know, I'm a woman, and I own an excavation business. There's not a woman that won't walk through my door I won't hire, and see if they work out and if, you know, it's something they want to do. But
Sandy,
you're in a carpenters union. It's not quite the same as placing that I've got 200 apprentices as it is on the civil side. The civil is definitely different. And I worked union contracting on the East Coast on the building side. So I understand that there are more people willing to do that, and minorities, but not specifically out in a construction site, 90-degree weather, dusty, dirty. Not a lot of women aren't really enjoying taking on to that job. They'd rather pick up a hammer.
Nelda, you were going to respond.
Just a couple of things that, you know, the state apprenticeship, our apprenticeship program, we can select direct entry from any of the 8 certified pre-apprenticeship programs that the state has looked at and said they meet a certain level. I don't know that process, but there's 8 of those. Women in the Trade is one of them, Irvington Covenant, you know, Job Corps. I mean, there's a list of those 8. So if we're out of somebody, we can always go and direct, you know, we have direct entry through those programs. So that's one thing. And like, capacity is an issue, because none of us in the training or, you know, necessarily have a crystal ball that's super accurate. And like I said, we kind of overshot this year. We indentured and, you know, added another 59 to our pool. We've got, you know, we already had about 20, so we've gotten, you know, maybe added 30 more to our workforce, but we still have 50 in our pool of eligibles who are waiting to be for their first dispatch. And right now we're running about half capacity of what we have ran as far as apprentices because of the economy, you know, so we're able to ramp up. It's just kind of getting the forecasting right is difficult. And then that continuity of jobs, I think that's why having a state goal is really important. So like Ron was saying, that female apprentice can actually get through her apprenticeship program. You know, there's a requirement for her to be there because, you know, I think women, it's been a struggle for women to be in the workforce, I mean, in general, and to get moved up into positions, you know.
With the Career Tech Ed Revitalization Grant that's been kind of ramping up in the pipeline for the last few years, is that one of your 8 programs that you look at to feed that pipeline? And is that's a connection we have not made yet?
That's a connection, and I took shop class in the 70s to the chagrin of my male shop teacher, but I didn't want to do home ec. So I took shop, and anyways, my dad was an operator, so that sounded like more fun to me. And so that's something that you can put on your in your application to a JATC, and so we would score that up higher because you have some industry-related training. So that's one of those things that gets you credit, is shop classes, good math scores, you know, those kinds of things.
But specifically, what we are investing in now with CTE isn't part of that connection.
Right.
Not yet. Yes, Ron.
We're planting seeds here.
Well, what I'd like to say is the selection method in my trade has not increased the amount of diversity. Our diversity has been largely because there's more women in the workplace now, and there's a lot more Mexicans in the workplace. And that's really what our workforce has reflected. And it has nothing to do with the methods of selection that I've seen those people come in. We have trouble getting anybody, when the economy's good, to want to be in our industry. Plumbing and heating is not a glamorous job. Cleaning drains, crawling underneath buildings, crawling underneath houses. I have 3 daughters, all 3 of them said no way. No way. But it's hard to get. I also have 3 sons, and I got one of them doing it. The other 2 said, no way. So it's getting people into a particular trade. They, A, are willing to put up with the work conditions for the economic benefit, and not everybody will do it. I would say 5% of the population is willing to do that. And that makes it very difficult to recruit anybody that's educated and smart enough to do this into the trade, especially with what was mentioned earlier, that we don't have that many people coming out of high school that are really educated to do trades. I mean,
Or who really understand the trade.
Yeah, well, my basic test that I do is a tape measure test, and half the people that apply at my shop can't read a tape measure correctly. I won't hire them. I've had people come from the apprenticeship selection, and I give them that test, and they couldn't pass it. So we've got some huge issues education-wise, what we're saying goes into trades, when our trades are steadily becoming more complex.
Yeah, they're not getting simpler.
Karen?
Yes. I just wanted to bring to light a few moments ago when there was a lot of discussion about lists and names on the books and discharging and things like that, but that's a union-based conversation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything to do with my world or the way that I run my business or the way that I get employees. My employees are permanent to my shop. They stay with me 7 to 10 years. I don't draw from any lists or call for dispatch of people. It's not part of my world, and I would assume that it's not that much part of the rural Oregon, the way they operate in these subcontracting or general contracting trades. So there's really 2 conversations taking place at this table. I really hope that the information floats to the top as to which side of the coin the conversation is relaying to. What you've heard is that union shops have an ample amount of apprentices on the books, and open shops, we can't get apprentices. So if you're going to implement regulation that requires the use of apprentices, exactly what side of the coin are you supporting there? Because in my mind, as an open shop, you're closing out opportunities for me because I can't even get apprentices, let alone a female. I mean, I can't even get a single apprentice. So I hope that you're able to balance the conversation of the different lines of work as it relates to trades.
And you can't get an apprentice because they can't get licensed? Was that that travel issue that you talked about?
Area 1 JATC, it's all occupied and filled by metro region apprentices. And I believe when you spoke about the 17 programs, that you're including union programs and open shop programs?
Of the 18 programs, those are open shop and union shop programs.
I hope everybody also knows that there are two lines of education. You choose to either go union or you choose to go open shop when you're an apprentice. I'm not able to get apprentices because people walk in my door. I would love to be able to hire them and employ them as it apparently used to be for a few months and then indenture them into the program. That's something that's not an option to me. I cannot hire anybody from my community.
John?
Yeah. Interesting discussions. We've talked about one of the things that I think is really important to apprenticeship quite at length today, and that's CTE, and there's been some great efforts over the past few years to increase that, and there's been a lot of focus about making sure those options are available around the state. If you look at the grants that we've approved, they go to every corner of the state. And we've been very mindful to make sure that that happens. And next session, we'll be looking at a bigger financial ask. And I hope all of you take the time and make the effort to come back and testify at the committees and talk to your legislators and tell them that that's important and that needs to happen. So that's one part. The second part is 90% plus of an apprentice's education is on the job. And so if there's not jobs available, if there's not public works projects being funded, if there's private work projects that are being held up because of permit issues or whatever the case might be, those are taking away potential work opportunities for apprentices. So I think we all need to be mindful of reasonable economic development and job creation in this state. And then it seems like we're talking a lot about a couple of things that I know are important to the conversation, but I don't think we have much control over, and that's selection procedure. Mr. Sims from Boley could probably take a couple of hours to inform all of us, at least much better than I'm informed right now, how a lot of these policies came into effect, why they're there. I'm sure some are federal, I'm sure some are state, but I don't think us as a task force is gonna have much to do with changing those. I just lost my train of thought on the flexibility inside of JATC. I don't know if you've ever reached out to your JATC and said, could we have training classes in the Dalles instead of going to Portland? And maybe that's none of my business. I don't know. But again, that's nothing we're going to change here. I think as we go forward and, you know, deliberate what, if any, of these make sense, I think we need to keep all those things in mind. But I think there's some of that stuff that we can't change. The JATCs are gonna have to change them. You know, if you feel you're not getting service properly from your JATC, then is there a big enough pool of apprentices in Hood River and Mosier and Skamania that can go to the Dalles instead of going to Portland? I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud. But I just think those are things that we can't change, that this task force can't change, but we need to be mindful of them as we deliberate going forward.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a couple more comments. John is sort of leading us into the last part of this meeting, which is, I think we're getting close to that. But Rod, do you want to say something?
Well, I kind of going back to some of the other contractors that have spoke as well at other meetings we've had, and it seems to me apprenticeship is a business model decision. It's clear to me here today that some employers see their employees in a certain light, and that's what they expect to do. And there's other employers that have different business models, and they utilize apprenticeship as it's designed or as it's established, whether it's right or wrong or indifferent. But it seems to me apprenticeship is a business model. It's not about the numbers. Clearly, you know, if you're doing interviews to make sure people are polite and people are conscientious and people know how to deal with customer service, I don't remember reading that in my apprenticeship standards, and we administer a lot of apprenticeship standards. So that, to me, is not necessarily the basis for apprenticeship. I think it's a business model, and I'm always concerned whenever we start making rules to mandate people participate in something that they in their own mind, don't agree with. I think that's a bad plan. It's a bad result. If we start mandating that people that don't really like the system are required to use it, the person that's going to suffer is the apprentice. And that's why I'm at the table, is because I want to make sure that every apprentice in our program is represented for what's best in their interest. And if that doesn't fit the employer's model, then that employer shouldn't hire that apprentice. Simple as that.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that that, you know, from my perspective, apprenticeship is also an educational model. Right, and that's part of the state's interest here. Just as we devote a lot of attention and a lot of resources into colleges and universities, you know, what are more traditionally seat time type learning, you know, I think many of us have a really strong interest in applied learning as a model that that really. Is successful with a number of people who are not as successful in the class or as interested in the classroom. And that model of on-the-job training is, you know, for me, what's really powerful about apprenticeship and the success. And so just from my perspective, I'm not as interested in the individual job. I'm more interested in the career pathway that the individual is on. I think starting from high school, you know, moving, however they're going to get there, towards apprenticeship, and then most importantly, to journeyman status, you know, so that they really have a career. And that's kind of what we're wrestling with here, I think. And let me say that, you know, as I look back over the various meetings that we've had, and this one is no exception, I think one area that I see universal consensus on is the importance of reinvesting in career technical education in our K-12 system. And, you know, figuring out ways to fund that and to create better pathways from our K-12 system to, you know, either community colleges or directly into the workforce. And maybe by way of pre-apprenticeship programs, I don't know, whatever it takes to get from here to there. And, you know, one of the things I think that we will, you know, I would like to see us do as a task force is wherever we end up with in terms of a model that we want to recommend for apprenticeship utilization, I think there are some very good recommendations that can come out of this task force in general about making improvements to the system, some of which we've heard today, I think, in terms of, you know, recognizing the special needs of rural apprentices and their employers. I don't know what that would look like at this point, but I think we're going to want to have in our report coming out of this task force something addressing that. I think we're going to want to have something addressing the CTE issue. And then perhaps, you know, something about utilization as well. So, yes, Rep. Johnson.
I'll throw one more component or one more thought to be considered to add to what you were referencing, but I think we also need to recognize that we need an apprenticeship program that works for the taxpayers of Oregon, too. I mean, we have situations in rural Oregon, as we've heard, where the workforce needs can't be met locally. It means necessarily that the crew that's going to perform that facet on that public contracting job is more than likely going to come in from out of town. Or out of state. And they're going to have increased costs. That job could, I'm almost certainly, be performed more inexpensively or cheaper by the local workforce than those folks would be in locally sourced. So my point would be, if you're talking about spending taxpayers' money on these public projects, that we would have more jobs and the taxpayer would get more bang for the buck if we had an apprenticeship program that can truly allow for the maximum utilization of apprentices. that come from the community in which the project is performed in. So I would just throw that out there.
All right, let's, we have just a few minutes left in today's meeting. And that, so let me, first of all, express my thanks to the panel for, you know, coming here and being part of this. It was great testimony from my perspective. I learned a lot from you. I really appreciate it. I guarantee that what you had to share with us is going to find its way into the final work of this committee. So thank you. So you have before you, Patrick put together five approaches that we have examined. The very last one, we haven't really examined it, although it's the one that really sparked this task force. In fact, the number 782 is somehow in the title of this task force. Senate 782 is kind of a combination of the first two approaches that are on the list. So, you know, just to kind of recap, not the first two, the second and the third, I'm sorry. You know, what Patrick gave us first was the current system. The second, the ODOT approach, which involves compensation to the general contractor for apprenticeship utilization. The third, the Washington approach, which sets minimum requirements by trade, is that right? Mm-hmm. Starting with 10% and then ramping up to 15%, is that right? Or maybe it started with 15%. Yeah.
Started with 10,
became 15, and there are some other ramp ups as far as who's covered and the size of the project. We had the proposal from NECA on responsible bidder, which is different from the previous two in that it's not looking at utilization per job, but utilization sort of record history, performance history by contractor or subcontractor. And that builds off our current system of JATCs. And then finally, the Senate Bill 782 approach, which, you know, as I said, combines the ODOT incentive component with a minimum requirement of 10%. That one came through the 2013 session, did not make its way through that session. That's why this task force was set up, because there was a lot of angst over that system, and we were tasked to see, is there a better way? Is there some way of combining different approaches in a different way? So next week is the deadline for us to put in a concept to Legislative Council to come up with a bill that would encapsulate the thinking of this committee. We are not at that point. We're at least a month away from having something concrete to recommend to them. So we'll put in what's called a placeholder bill that will, it'll be there as a framework if we do have recommendations that we can reach consensus on to put into that bill. We did at the beginning of this process commit to trying to achieve a large degree of consensus. You know, we don't want to have a situation in which, you know, 55% of us feel one way, 45% another, and that becomes the legislation, because that's not what this is all about. So what we're gonna try to do, I think, is see is there one of these models or combination of these models that we can reach consensus on over the next month. Katie, is that fair to say?
I think that summarizes it nicely.
Yeah. I mean, as I said before, I think there are some things around CTE that we do have consensus around. And I'm not quite sure what that would look like in a bill, but certainly there are ongoing efforts for us to enhance our use of CTE. And many of us are going to be very engaged in that process. But can we reach consensus on some other model? So what I'd like us to be able to do is look at the upsides, downsides to these different models to see if there is one that we could reach consensus on.
Or Michael, Katie? maybe of the five, as you mentioned a minute ago, a combination of some sort. Maybe there's a hybrid that we haven't looked at here.
Right.
Maybe there's something else that's creative that we haven't considered.
Yes, Barry.
Going through these and listening to all the testimony, the one that went forward in the bill, it limits. I don't like the 5 million because there's a whole lot of projects under 5 million where we could utilize this apprenticeship, and I think it would be a really good thing. I can see on the larger ones having a percentage because there's enough resources to be able to do that, because it's a good job, you know, it's a large amount of money, so there's resources within my staff and, you know, the contractors to be able to do some of these numbers and making sure that we meet the numbers. And I like the NECA that you're going to utilize people that are part of the training. So you're kind of getting, and so I'm thinking maybe smaller ones, that would be a good avenue. Because I'd love to be able to bring in, and I think that would help to bring in smaller, you know, like in Hood River when times are tough there, that they could bid jobs in Portland and work on some of the projects that we have all year long in Portland. And we are doing a lot of electrical work with the retrofitting into LEDs, and, you know, they're up in the 700,000s, but they're not, you know, 1-2 million, and they're good jobs, and they're pretty good sized jobs. You know, a lot of labor, not a whole lot in costs as far as the equipment, but a lot of labor. And so it's a great opportunity for folks in those industries to do that. And so I do kind of see potentially a combination where the larger jobs is a percentage, and then anything under some number, you just look at that they're enrolled or that they have, you know, they're using or utilizing apprenticeships, because then you get the education. There's work out there for them, and I think you could promote that. Mm-hmm. And having that high number, there's a lot of work that we're missing that I think is important.
Let me ask a sort of devil's advocate question. You know, I too am I think I'm thinking quite similar to you, but, you know, with the with the responsible bidder kind of model, where we're trying to encourage firms to become training agents, you know, which I totally agree with that. What do you do with the rural shop, the small rural shop that doesn't have enough work that they can have a record of being a training agent, and then to be able to bid on the bigger jobs elsewhere in the state?
Well, I don't know, but I think that if we had this as a requirement, and they are one of these responsible bidders, there might be opportunities where locally, but then you've got the local businesses going, well, it's not fair that, but you're going to have that either way. But I think that they would be able to bid on local projects because of that requirement, that they can compete with the locals, because maybe they're the only one on a $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 job that they would have that, and they're part of that training, and that they could then bid and have a good shot at it, because we're going to look at weighing in their favor. So I think it would help, and I'd like to hear from other folks what they think.
Okay, Tom, then Ron.
So I guess my concern with, you know, I'll try to encapsulate here, but My concern with a responsible bidder is, one, when you talk about, it's not just small rural shops, it's small metro shops, it's of being of size to be able to have that in-house, that training agent. And when we talk amongst here quickly trying to look at something like that, we're talking about people's livelihoods, mm-hmm. and family businesses that have gone on and on to suddenly jump into something like that. That causes me substantial concern. Going to Senate Bill 782 as it was originally put forth, one of the elements, I'm speaking to you, Barry, but in general, you know, from AGC standpoint, and we have a core position, we have vetted this thing for the past decade, because we do capture all of the state geographical, large, small, union, open shop, that whole given piece. And this was what we could get consensus coming out of that, which we feel is a good reflection of industry. And that is, one is starting, phasing it in. Starting at if there's going to be a utilization, it's going to be a reasonable amount. And again, that models what Washington did to grow the piece in. The $5 million was to phase it in. Because once again, we can use the example of, you can't jump in and say, well, we're just going to do this in Metro and not the rest of the state. I don't think mm-hmm. the state's going to allow that. So again, if you have apprenticeship utilization going active and engaged in the metro areas in the I-5 corridor, and then you jump over to John Day and you put a project out that has those requirements, and there's the locals, and there isn't the access. I mean, we've heard great testimony of that given piece. Now you're really pushing the work to out of area metros who have the apprenticeship programs, and so we want to be able to phase that in over time, so that throughout the community colleges and all the varying training pieces taking place. The other thing very important to us that, and we heard the testimony from ODOT that they tried it and the lack of success, is the non-craft specific. Very, very important piece. And then lastly, the incentive was really more driven for, and again, a lesson learned from the ODOT side, is non-penalty driven. I know that is that's contentious on a lot of different fronts, but again, modeled after the Washington side, because once again, we want to grow our workforce. But I just real quickly encapsulate Senate Bill 782 in that it is, and ultimately, I guess, to remind some and educate those that haven't. At least over the past 6 years that I've been aware of it, and I think it's gone on and on and on, you know, the reason this task force, I think, exists is because apprenticeship has been whack-a-mole. Every session it comes out. Industry, if there's, everybody's got a view. Everybody's got a view. And so then there's multiple bills every given session, and industry goes before your varying committees and eats itself and fights over these different things. And that's... I think the role of the task force, and so respectfully, I guess I would put, and I don't know the answer to this, but one thing out is so here we are, as we started this and talked about consensus, and that, you know what, we want to hear really from the three groups, you know, those that are the apprentices themselves being trained, and from the trainers and educators, and then from industry, and yet we've just heard that piece. And we're going to try to come together with something in a month that industry has wrestled with. And I'm a rookie in all of this sort of stuff in Salem here, but I do have experience going through the CMGC, and that was a 2-year process of just tons of collaboration of all of us talking. And I understand the need to get something going, but on the other hand, I also don't want to disband this fantastic opportunity with incredible wisdom around the table, that whether if something does go, that at least continues dialogue of how we look at this. Because from a union side, Apprenticeship works very easily on our end, and we have the opportunity and with the carpenters of being able to have a son of a superintendent who loves the trade, and we can go to him and we can get them through it and hired, and now he's a superintendent for us. And people that have been with me for excess of 20 years that I hear on the open shop side may not be available through the JATC. So with that end, I mean, I don't know how that all goes other than I would hate to have this opportunity and we wrap it up in a month and walk away with.
No.
And that could be, let me just say, that could be the recommendation of this task force, is that we're on a good path and there's more to be done. But, you know, there's a part of me that is impatient, and there's a part of me that but largely we want to do this right. Sandy?
Yeah, I'd like to just make a comment that, you know, we have five different ideas, and one that actually hasn't been utilized, which is the 782. And NECA hasn't been utilized. So I think that to say we're going to take a program that worked for somebody else and say it's going to be one shoe, it's going to fit for what we mm-hmm. need to do, I think you're right. We might need to take pieces of these programs. The one I have a little difficulty with is the responsible bidder, and I think what you heard from Karen say, it's very costly for a small contractor. Because if she does a portion, 20%, 25% of her work, her labor, 100%, will have to pay towards being a responsible apprentice trainer. Mm. And so it gets costly for small. And so we have to think about small businesses, union businesses, open shop businesses, rural businesses. There's a lot of different facets to this that we really need to vet through if we want to be successful, if the task force really wants to go forward with something that's going to be meaningful. So
that's
my comment. Right, yeah. Kind of interesting conversation today, and I appreciate that we were kind of got a little firmer outline of the ideas. And going back, and I looked at some of the documents that formed this committee and was just reading through that this weekend, and some of the things in here were incentives and disincentives that would lead contractors to comply with the apprenticeship utilization standard. Lowering over time the contract price at which the apprenticeship utilization standard would apply. Increasing over a period of time the percentage of total work hours and workers in apprenticeable occupations perform on public improvement. Strategies for creating more diversity. Methods for monitoring compliance with the apprenticeship utilization standard, and identifying projects that may be exempted, which I think is important as well. For me, I think you know, ODOT has a program that, you know, they seem to be happy with. I mean, it seems to be working. In looking at the responsible bidder link, a lot of that, you know, I could agree with. I'm not sure what a satisfactory record of integrity or how you establish what that means exactly, but the one thing that seemed missing there was actual jobs for apprentices. You would have a registered training agent, but there wouldn't be any necessarily a job there for an apprentice. I think the current approach, you know, has got us where we're at right now, so I guess I'd leave it there. That's what.
Pro.
I like a few of the things that have been commented. I really like the idea of the global approach that Nilda mentioned earlier, and some of your comments about, you know, this is bigger than a job specific type of mm-hmm. thing. This is an industry thing. I think everybody's all on the same page there, is that, you know, it's public work, it's private work that all needs workforce development. And I personally like the idea of continuing this group, because some of the things that I'm a little bit worried about is, like, on the ODOT approach, for example, or the South Waterfront approach. If that was in multiple cities statewide, then it wouldn't work anymore. because how it's working now is because there's fewer of those programs and people are managing where their workforce goes to accommodate those things. So we have to be careful that we don't break something in the effort of fixing something. And secondly, what I'm really concerned about is that we take the time to approach something so that we don't come up with a solution that the unintended consequence is displacing that long-term journey level worker. Because you take like that smaller rural shop, maybe they got 8 people that work there and they've all been part of that. They were a training agent, maybe they started out with one person, that person hired an apprentice, that person turned out in 4 years, now there's 2 of them, they get to hire another one, and they built up to a level where laws of economics came into play and they stopped growing because they didn't have more work to do. Now if we tell them you can't play in the sandbox unless you hire more apprentices, the only way they can do that is let go of somebody who's been a long-term person. So we have to make sure that that's not an unintended consequence to whatever we do. Personally, I think we need more time.
Don, we'll give you the last word. Make it good. Well,
just a couple of comments on a couple of different systems we're talking about. Personally, I like some of the components of the responsible contractor. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tie anybody to any craft-specific numbers or job numbers, and I'm a believer too in that you need to look at the whole system and the whole workforce. And mm-hmm. and you know, if an apprentice gets drug off of working 6-10s out at Intel to go satisfy a 40-hour a week job someplace else, that might not be a good outcome for that apprentice. So there's certain things that I like about that. I don't understand, and I wish Karen was still here, because it sounds like she's been doing apprenticeship training for 20 years, open shop up the gorge, and would like to hire more apprentices. So why if you really want to hire apprentices and have more apprentices and feed your workforce, why would you not want to be a registered training agent?
I can answer that.
That's a disconnect to me that I don't understand. And then just real quick on the ODOT, and that system might work fine for them, and I'm not advocating that this task force do anything to monkey with that system, but I and my council is not interested in replicating a system that pays contractors by the hour to do apprentices. A lot of us have apprenticeship programs that have been in existence for over 100 years around here. The open shop ones have been doing it for 20, 30 years without any taxpayer dollars flowing in to hire apprentices. I don't think that's where this conversation should be going.
Okay, thank you.
We shouldn't have to pay contractors to hire.
So we gave you the last civilian word. Now we have some quick words from our legislators.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think today's conversation has been really good. It's been enlightening. I think it's been productive, but I think it's shined the light on the fact that there's still a lot that we don't know. Mm-hmm. I think every time we overturn another rock, we find more stuff we haven't considered yet, which I think is a good thing. But I don't think that should drive us to feel like we have to meet some sort of a timeline to come up with some sort of a work, you know. And I think it would be perfectly okay for this group to come away with some recommendations and some findings.
A preliminary.
But say that, you know, our work's not done yet. We would love to see this task force reauthorized to continue to do this work. But I do think there could be some things we could conceptually certainly get behind, and one of those would be a significant effort to expand CTE programs, mm-hmm. perhaps through our community colleges. Because I mean, as we start to if we're going to talk about ratios, do we even know that the pipeline's sufficient to meet the workforce demands that any sort of ratios would entail? Have we started counting bodies, and how many of these and how many of those do we have, and are they even out there, or are they in the process of being trained, and how long would it take the system to get them up and ready? So I think there's a lot that we have left to learn here, and I would love to feel, at the end of the day, feel like we really did a good body of work that's good for industry, good for Oregon's economy, and good for our workforce developments for a long time, rather than feel like we get kind of shoehorned into a time frame, which I know, you know, we all have, and we all obviously, or at least 3 of us, have the opportunity to drop member bills, too, that could help further this process, too, so we're not bound by the committee constraints, you know. So that would be my 2 cents.
Well, I think this has been a great conversation. It's been very helpful for me. Would it be, as we wrap up today, because I know we all have busy schedules today and need to move on, Would it be helpful? It would be helpful for me, I will say, if we could get some kind of a consensus from everyone on the panel as to how you view these five proposals or a hybridized version of any of these. Would it be reasonable to ask that between now and when we schedule our next meeting that you contact Patrick in whatever means works for you and just give him a sense of what things you like, what things you don't like, if there are combinations of things you would be interested in pursuing, just to give the senator and myself a sense of where we are, because I really don't have a sense of where we all are at this point in time. And then when we schedule our October meeting, we could visit that and then decide what the path forward would be, whether maybe we have more consensus than we think. Maybe there is a recommendation that could come out of this and make a decision at that point whether or not we move forward with the task force, which I have no problem with and I think may be of great value.
Yeah, I appreciate that suggestion. Would it be reasonable to ask for that feedback within 2 weeks?
Sure.
Say?
Sure.
And then Patrick can assemble it. Yeah, you just send it to Patrick. We can assemble it and, we'll certainly share the results and maybe we'll see some trends there that will be useful at the next meeting.
Yes, so just so that we're all on the same page and we provide you the same information, so would it be that we go through all of these five, say what we think or what we like about them, what we see as negatives about them, and which say, well, not really much in favor of this one?
I'm more interested in what you see that's okay, productive
so
and positive. Yeah. To save you time, tell us if there's anything in here you like or a combination of things that you like. Because there may be something in here that you would see as a potential combination that we haven't identified.
Gotcha.
So be creative with how you approach it would be my wisdom.
Okay.
We like Portland.
Yeah. Really good too. So.
That's right. Okay, we'll let you. Patrick will poll everyone on, and we'll get a meeting date sometime in October. Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Very productive 2 hours. With that, I am calling this meeting of the task force to a close.
Thanks to the contractors that came in. Even though there's only one left here.
Thanks to the contractor.